So today, the day after Independence Day, I would like to talk about the life of a man who may have been the single most significant figure in the birth of the American nation, Thomas Paine. So today's sermon is a brief biographical sketch of the man, that man who pens such immortal lines as, "The world is my country, all mankind are my brethren, to do good is my religion." And, "Injustice to one person is injustice to all." And he was the one who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." In his 72 years, Tom Paine did more than any other person to inspire with eloquent words the revolutionary spirit. And yet, he was widely disliked, even by some of his fellow revolutionaries. In June of 1809, when Tom Paine lay on his deathbed, he confided to his friends that he was afraid his enemies would never let him rest in peace. He had asked to be buried in a Quaker cemetery, but the request was denied by a Quaker church. After Paine died in his sleep on June 8th of that year, 1809, his friend from France, Marguerite de Bonneville, saw to it that he was buried properly in New Rochelle, New York. As she later described the scene, "Contemplating who it was, what man it was, that we were committing to an obscure grave, I could not help feeling most acutely, before the earth was thrown down upon the coffin, I, placing myself at the east end of the grave, said to my son Benjamin, 'Stand you there at the other end as a witness for grateful America.' Looking around me and beholding the small group of spectators, I exclaimed as the earth was tumbled into the grave, 'Oh, Mr. Paine, my son stands here as testimony for the gratitude of America, and I for France.'" Well, that's a pretty sad scene for such an influential patriot, one that we now learn about, at least a little about, in grade school. In many ways, Tom Paine's ideas were way ahead of his time. Even today, though he is regarded as a great patriot, his tremendous influence on those who founded our nation is not fully acknowledged or widely understood. Thomas Paine was born in Thetford, England, in 1737. He was the son of a staymaker. That is, he made thick ropes that are used to anchor sails on ships. Those were the stays that refers to. However, some biographers, not long after his death, said that he erroneously reported that he was making stays, the other kind of stays, for ladies' corsets. An implement of torture, I'm glad, doesn't exist anymore. And they did that as part of their effort to insult him, even after his death. But the stays he made, biographers have discovered since, and that was believed for many decades, were actually the ropes that hold down the sails, very thick ropes. Tom's father was a Quaker, and his mother was an Anglican. He was lucky enough to have had some education. Tom was especially inspired by history, science, mathematics, and poetry. But he was eventually expected to take up his father's occupation and was made an apprentice in his father's staymaker shop. He grew restless making stays, and he tried to escape at the age of 16 by signing on as a sailor on a ship called the Terrible, under a captain with the ominous name Death. Would you sail on such a ship? Well, Tom's father came and dragged him back home. When he was 19, war was declared against France, and Tom, still harboring that sea dream, signed on to sail on a warship over his father's pacifist father's protest. His father was a Quaker. This adventure seemed to have cured him of his sea longing, but it inspired in him an interest in astronomy and dreamy speculation about other planets circling distant suns and possibly supporting life. These were advanced ideas for his time that he was later to write about. After a year at sea, he went to London and worked again at staymaking. Eventually, he set up his own staymaking business in Sandwich near Dover. At age 22, he married a young woman who was employed as a maid. But soon, his business failed, and then his young wife died in childbirth, and the child died as well. So he became an officer of customs and excise, a very poorly paid occupation. At age 31, he got a position at the excise office in Lewes and took up lodging in the home of a tobacconist named Samuel Olive. Through Mr. Olive, Payne became active in the civic life of the town, and he frequented a local hotel where men would come to discuss politics. They would also recite poetry and drink to each other's health. When Olive died, Payne moved out but stayed close to the Olive family, helping his widow run the tobacco shop. 2 years later, Payne married the widow's daughter, Elizabeth Olive, and moved back into the house. But he was really not much of a businessman, and the family business failed. Meanwhile, Payne had become a kind of self-appointed shop steward on behalf of the poorly paid excisemen like himself, and he produced a pamphlet. It was titled The Case of the Officers of Excise, which was the debut of his later famous pamphleteering career. He distributed this very well-written pamphlet to members of Parliament. Payne was soon after dismissed from his excise post, the stated reason being that he had taken an unauthorized leave to deal with his mounting debts, but it is entirely possible, though not certain, that he was dismissed essentially for being a rabble-rouser. Years later, the British radical William Cobbett said that Payne's dismissal from his government post in England was the real cause of the American Revolution. Payne's second marriage did not work out for reasons neither he nor his wife would ever discuss. They separated amicably, and in subsequent years, Payne would often send her money anonymously. With nothing left to lose, at the age of 37, Payne left for America. He left carrying a recommendation for employment from Benjamin Franklin, whom he was introduced to in London because of their mutual interest, Franklin's and his, in science. In America, he found his calling as a writer, using his eloquence to advocate for causes he believed in. He became co-editor of Pennsylvania Magazine and wrote sharply critical pieces against slavery. And he was doing this long before the abolitionist movement. He also wrote a tract on the equality of women, again, long before this was common. After the famous confrontation of British and American troops at Lexington and Concord in 1775, Payne wrote political pieces against British rule in America. On November 1st, 1775, The British king declared the American colonies to be in a state of rebellion, and Paine immediately wrote three essays in response. This, put together, was his famous work, Common Sense. In it, he universalized the American cause, declaring, "The cause in America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind." He ended by calling for a completely independent America, something few dared to suggest at that point. "The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth," he said of the American Revolution. He wrote, "'Tis not the affair of a city, a country, a province, or a kingdom, but of a continent of at least one-eighth part of the habitable globe. Tis not the concern of a day, a year, or an age. Posterity are virtually involved in the contest and will be more or less affected, even to the end of time, by the proceedings now. Now is the seed time of continental union, faith, and honor." The ideas expressed in Common Sense, that all people are by nature equal, and that monarchy is unjust and unreasonable, made their way into the Declaration of Independence. In fact, it has been suggested by some scholars that the very first draft of this declaration was written not by Thomas Jefferson, but by Thomas Paine, and that Paine, by mutual agreement with Jefferson, remained a ghostwriter because he was by then considered too radical a revolutionary to be seen as the official spokesman for the cause. After the Declaration of Independence was signed, America was finally at war not just for tax relief, but for freedom. And it was Thomas Paine whose words kept both leaders and soldiers inspired to keep fighting through the long and hard war. Paine volunteered in the Continental Army and was asked to produce pamphlets to lift the flagging spirits of the soldiers. Over 6 years, he published a very influential series of essays called American Crisis, and his words were stirring. "These are the times that try men's souls," he wrote. "Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered, yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." George Washington and others acknowledged America's deep indebtedness to Paine for his words of inspiration. Well, when America achieved independence, Paine, the professional revolutionary, lost interest. He did not play an active part in forming the new government. Instead, he turned his attention to another interest. This was his invention and design of an iron bridge, a design which is still used on highways to this day. Paine went to Europe with his plans for the bridge, hoping to get France interested. For a while, the bridge took his mind from politics. He had expected to stay abroad for a few months, but he became involved again in politics and wound up staying abroad for 15 years. Much happened during those years in Europe. While living in England, Paine wrote The Rights of Man, which he intended to be a revolutionary handbook for all of Europe. In it, he wrote, "We must shut our eyes against reason. We must basely degrade our understanding not to see the folly of what was called monarchy. Nature is orderly in all her works, but this is a mode of government that counteracts nature. It turns the progress of human faculties upside down. It subjects age to be governed by children and wisdom by folly. On the contrary, the representative system is always parallel with the order and immutable laws of nature and meets the reason of man in every part." You can see how plain spoken he is, and yet eloquent in his way. Paine's life had already been in danger in England since 1776, but his new book made it even more dangerous for him to stay there. Whenever he walked through the streets of England, people, even working people whose rights Paine had in mind, would chant a well-known rhyme. Paine, Paine, damned be his name, damned be his fame and lasting his shame. God damn Paine, God damn Paine. Joseph Johnson, the man who published Paine's The Rights of Man, was called before the court on the charge of treason to the British Crown for printing the book. England was not ready for a revolution, but they were ready to hang Tom Paine. Paine was warned by the radical poet William Blake that he should leave England, and by some accounts he left not a moment too soon, with British officers hot on his trail. So Paine fled to France. At least there, a revolution was already underway. The French considered Paine a hero, and he was made a delegate to the National Assembly. General Lafayette gave him the giant key to the Bastille as a gesture of honor. Back in England, Paine was being burned in effigy, along with Unitarian minister and scientist Joseph Priestley. But in France, he was respected. That is, until the French Revolution turned into the Reign of Terror. Paine found himself on Robespierre's enemies list because he had voted against the execution of the dethroned king, Louis XVI. While in prison, he saw friends and cellmates one by one go to the guillotine. He was sure he'd be next. He wrote a plea to George Washington and got no response. Later, Thomas Jefferson explained that it would have been diplomatically unstrategic for Washington to prevail upon the ruling French party asking for Paine's life. Well, Paine never forgave Washington for not trying to free him. Finally, when James Monroe became minister to France, he got Paine released. Paine barely escaped the guillotine. He was very weak when he left prison. He had an abscess in his side. The Monroes nursed him back to health. While in the French prison, Paine began to write another of his major works, The Age of Reason. This one was on religion, and in this he set forth his own beliefs. I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. And he continued, but lest it be supposed that I believe many other things in addition to these, I shall, in the progress of this work, declare the things I do not believe and my reasons for not believing them. Does that sound familiar? have been known as those who are say more easily what we don't believe than what we do. So we're getting better at explaining what we do believe. So here's Paine. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish church, by the Roman church, by the Greek church, by the Turkish church, by the Protestant church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. I do not mean by this declaration to condemn those who believe otherwise. You can see why he got himself in trouble. They have the same right to their belief as I have to mine, but it is necessary to the happiness of man that he be mentally faithful to himself. Infidelity does not consist in believing or in disbelieving. It consists in professing to believe what one does not believe. For these and other pronouncements like this, Tom Paine was accused of being an atheist. But he was not. He was a deist, like Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, and many others of his day, including many who called themselves Unitarians. The deists believe that God set the universe and its laws going, but God does not intervene in human affairs. Paine was not a member of any Unitarian group in those days before an official Unitarian denomination. Nor was he was Unitarian with a small u, in that he clearly was not a Trinitarian, did not buy that doctrine. Nor was he a Quaker like his father, although the Quaker influence can be seen throughout his religious and his political writings. In The Age of Reason, Paine said, "I cannot help smiling at the conceit that if the taste of a Quaker could have been consulted at the creation, what a silent and drab-colored creation it would have been." So he didn't spare the tradition he grew up in either. He similarly criticized other organized religions. He was truly a man who followed his own lights. "My mind is my own church," he said. Paine had one final and disappointing encounter with the New Republic of France, which he had such high hopes for. This disappointment came through his meeting with Napoleon Bonaparte, who visited Paine's home and flattered him, saying that every city should have a gold statue of Tom Paine. Then Napoleon revealed his true ambition, an empire, not a world of equal rights for all. Paine returned to America, where he also had many detractors, people who were far less radical than he, people who were enjoying their post-war comforts and who kept slaves, a practice he detested. Some were Tories, counter-revolutionaries, living comfortably in a country born of revolution. In 1804, on election day, Paine went to the polls in New York to vote, and a young supervisor there refused to count Paine's ballot, saying that he wasn't a good citizen, believing what he'd heard, that Tom Paine was not a good American. Because Paine was so outspoken in both his political and religious writings, he acquired enemies. Some of them, posthumous biographers, who accused him of everything from personal uncleanliness to drunkenness, adultery, atheism, and dishonesty. Though he did like his brandy, his bad reputation is undeserved, as biographers in more recent years have discovered. In June of 1809, as he lay dying, Tom Paine was visited by well-meaning people who tried to get him to recant his religious heresies and profess faith in Jesus as the Son of God. He refused rather emphatically each time and died an unrepentant heretic, a Unitarian theologically. He was a man who refused to run with the world's opinions. Well, old Tom Paine was right. He did not rest in peace. But it was not because of his enemies, as he had feared. British writer and radical William Cobbett, who once criticized Paine but then became an ardent admirer, crept into the graveyard in New Rochelle, New York, one night and stole the coffin. Cobbett shipped it to England, believing that a public display of the remains would attract a large crowd, and that would lead to reform in the British government and in the Church of England. But the British public ignored the exhibition, and in both England and America, school children chanted this unkind rhyme: "Poor Tom Paine, here he lies, nobody laughs and nobody cries. Where he's gone and how he fares, nobody knows and nobody cares." Cobbett willed Payne's bones to his son, who then went bankrupt and tried to sell the bones. But the Lord Chancellor at the time said they were worth nothing. Unfortunately, the bones vanished. But what's more important, Tom Paine's words remain for posterity. Reading them now, they don't sound as radical and advanced as they once did, but they do ring true down through the ages. And we still need words of inspiration like those of Tom Paine, because the American Revolution is not yet finished. What do we dare to dream? I want to close with Paine's words that I know you Unitarian Universalists would appreciate. Just two short quotes. "If I do not believe as you believe, it proves that you do not believe as I believe, and that is all it proves." And then, "It is error only and not truth that shrinks from inquiry."